The Stand by Stephen King. Author's note. This is a work of fiction. Many of the events occur in real places, and with these places I have taken the liberty of changing them to whatever degree best suited the course of my story. This is a monstrous impertinence, and that is as good a definition of the word novel as any. Special thanks are due to Russell Dorr, PA, and Dr. Richard Herman, both of the Bridgeton Family Medical Center, who answered my questions about the nature of the flu and its peculiar way of mutating every 2 years or so, and to Susan Arts Manning of Castine, who proofed the original manuscript. Most thanks of all to Bill Thompson and Betty Prashker, who made this book happen in the best way. Stephen King. Dedication. For my wife, Tabitha, this dark chest of wonders. Outside, the street's on fire, in a real death waltz, between what's flesh and what's fantasy, and the poets down here don't write nothing at all, they just stand back and let it all be, and in the quick of the night, they reach for their moment and try to make an honest stand. Bruce Springsteen. And it was clear she couldn't go on. The door was opened and the wind appeared. The candles blew and then disappeared. The curtains flew and then he appeared. Said, "Don't be afraid. Come on, Mary." And she had no fear, and she ran to him, and they started to fly. She had taken his hand. "Come on, Mary. Don't fear the Reaper." Blue Oyster Cult. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount, but nothing really matters much. It's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a futile horn. "Come in," she said. "I'll give you shelter from the storm." Bob Dylan. Book 1. Captain Trips. June 16th to July 4th, 1980. I called the doctor on the telephone, said, "Doctor, doctor, please. I got this feeling, rocking and reeling. Tell me, what can it be? Is it some new disease?" The Silvers. "Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Baby, can you dig your man?" Larry Underwood. Chapter 1. Hapscom's Texaco sat on U.S. 93 just north of Arnett, a pissant four-street burg about 110 miles from Houston. Tonight the regulars were there, sitting by the cash register, drinking beer, talking idly, watching the bugs fly into the big lighted sign. It was Bill Hapscom's station, so the others deferred to him even though he was a pure fool. They would have expected the same deferral if they had been gathered together in one of their business establishments, except they had none. In Arnett, it was hard times. In 1970, the town had had two industries, a factory that made paper products, for picnics and barbecues mostly, and a plant that made electronic calculators. Now the paper factory was shut down, and the calculator plant was ailing. They could make them a lot cheaper in Taiwan, it turned out, just like those little portable TVs and transistor radios. Norman Bruett and Tommy Wanamaker, who had both worked in the paper factory, were on relief, having run out of unemployment some time ago. Henry Carmichael and Stu Redmond both worked at the calculator plant, but rarely got more than 30 hours a week. Victor Palfrey was retired and smoked stinking home-rolled cigarettes, which were all he could afford. "Now, what I say is this," Hap told them, putting his hands on his knees and leaning forward. "They just gotta say, screw this inflation shit. Screw this national debt shit. We got the presses and we got the paper. We're gonna run off $50,000,000 bills and hump them right the Christ into circulation." Palfrey, who had been a machinist until 1974, was the only one present with sufficient self-respect to point out Hap's most obvious damn fool statements. Now, rolling another of his shitty-smelling cigarettes, he said, "That wouldn't get us nowhere. If they do that, it'll be just like Richmond in the last 2 years of the States War. In those days, when you wanted a piece of gingerbread, you gave the baker a Confederate dollar, he'd put it on the gingerbread and cut out a piece just that size. Money's just paper, you know." "I know some people that don't agree with you," Hap said sourly. He picked up a greasy red plastic paper holder from his desk. I owe these people, and they're starting to get pretty itchy about it. Stu Redman, who was perhaps the quietest man in Arnett, was sitting in one of the cracked plastic Woolco chairs, a can of Pabst in his hand, looking out the big service station window at 93. Stu knew about poor. He had grown up that way right here in town, the son of a dentist who had died when Stu was 7, leaving his wife and 2 other children besides Stu. His mother had gotten work at the Red Ball truck stop just outside of Arnett. Stu could have seen it from where he sat right now if it hadn't burned down in 1969. It had been enough to keep the 4 of them eating, but that was all. At the age of 9, Stu had gone to work, first for Rog Tucker, who owned the Red Ball, helping to unload trucks after school for 35 cents an hour, and then at the stockyards in the neighboring town of Braintree, lying about his age to get 20 backbreaking hours of labor a week at the minimum wage. Now, listening to Hap and Vic Palfrey argue on about money and the mysterious way it had of drying up, he thought about the way his hands had bled at first from pulling the endless hand trucks of hides and guts. He had tried to keep that from his mother, but she had seen, less than a week after he started. She wept over them a little, and she hadn't been a woman who wept easily. But she hadn't asked him to quit the job. She knew what the situation was. She was a realist. Some of the silence in him came from the fact that he had never had friends or the time for them. There was school, and there was work. His youngest brother, Dev, had died of pneumonia the year he began at the yards, and Stu had never quite gotten over that. Guilt, he supposed. He had loved Dev the best. But his passing had also meant there was one less mouth to feed. In high school, he had found football, and that was something his mother had encouraged, even though it cut into his work hours. "You play," she said. "If you got a ticket out of here, it's football, Stuart. You play. Remember Eddie Warfield." Eddie Warfield was a local hero. He had come from a family even poorer than Stu's own, had covered himself with glory as quarterback of the regional high school team, had gone on to Texas A&M with an athletic scholarship, and had played for 10 years with the Green Bay Packers, mostly as a second-string quarterback, but on several memorable occasions as the starter. Eddie now owned a string of fast food restaurants across the West and Southwest, and in Arnett he was an enduring figure of myth. In Arnett, when you said success, you meant Eddie Warfield. Stu was no quarterback, and he was no Eddie Warfield. But it did seem to him as he began his junior year in high school that there was at least a fighting chance for him to get a small athletic scholarship. And then there were work-study programs, and the school's guidance counselor had told him about the NDEA loan program. Then his mother had gotten sick, had become unable to work. It was cancer. 2 months before he graduated from high school, she had died, leaving Stu and his brother Bryce to support. Stu had turned down the athletic scholarship and had gone to work in the calculator factory. And finally it was Bryce, 3 years Stu's junior, who had made out. He was now in Minnesota, a systems analyst for IBM. He didn't write often, and the last time he had seen Bryce was at the funeral, after Stu's wife had died. Died of exactly the same sort of cancer that had killed his mother. He thought that Bryce might have his own guilt to carry, and that Bryce might be a little ashamed of the fact that his brother had turned into just another good old boy in a dying Texas town, spending his days doing time in the calculator plant, and his nights either down at Hap's or over at the Indian Head drinking Lone Star beer. The marriage had been the best time, and it had only lasted 18 months. The womb of his young wife had borne a single dark and malignant child. That had been 3 years ago. Since, he had thought of leaving Arnett, searching for something better. But small-town inertia held him, the low siren song of familiar places and familiar faces. He was well-liked in Arnett, and Vic Palfrey had once paid him the ultimate compliment of calling him old-time tough. As Vic and Hap chewed it out, there was still a little dusk left in the sky, but the land was in shadow. Cars didn't go by on 93 much now, which was one reason Hap had so many unpaid bills. But there was a car coming now, Stu saw. It was still a quarter of a mile distant, the day's last light putting a dusty shine on what little chrome was left to it. Stu's eyes were sharp, and he made it as a very old Chevrolet, 59 or 60. A Chevy, no lights on, doing no more than 15 miles an hour, weaving all over the road. No one had seen it yet but him. Now, let's say you got a mortgage payment on this station, Vic Palfrey was saying. And let's say it's $50 a month. It's a hell of a lot more than that. Well, for the sake of argument, let's say 50. And let's say the Federals went ahead and printed you a whole carload of money. Well, then those bank people would turn around and want 150. You'd just be as poorly off. That's right, Henry Carmichael nodded. Hap looked at him, irritated. He happened to know that Hank had gotten in the habit of taking cokes out of the machine without paying the deposit. And furthermore, Hank knew he knew, and if Hank wanted to come in on any side, it ought to be his. That ain't necessarily how it would be, Hap said weightily from the depths of his ninth grade education. He went on to explain why. Stu, who only understood that they were all in a hell of a pinch, turned Hap's voice down to a meaningless drone and watched the Chevy pitch and yaw its way on up the road. The way it was going, Stu didn't think it was going to make it much further. It crossed the white line and its left-hand tires spumed up dust from the left shoulder. Now it lurched back, held its own lane briefly, then nearly pitched off into the ditch. Then, as if the driver had picked out the big, lighted Texaco station sign as a beacon, it arrowed toward the tarmac like a projectile whose velocity is very nearly spent. Stu could hear the worn-out thump of its engine now, the steady gurgle and wheeze of a dying carb and a loose set of valves. It missed the lower entrance and bumped up over the curb. The fluorescent bars over the pumps were reflecting off the Chevy's dirt-streaked windshield, so it was hard to see what was inside. But Stu saw the vague shape of the driver roll loosely with the bump. The car showed no sign of slowing from its relentless 15. So I say, with more money in circulation, you'd be... Better turn off your pumps, Hap, Stu said mildly. The pumps? What? Norm Brouette had turned to look out the window. Christ on a pony, he said. Stu got out of his chair, leaned over Tommy Wanamaker and Hank Carmichael, and flicked off all eight switches at once, four with each hand. So he was the only one who didn't see the Chev as it hit the gas pumps on the upper island and sheared them off. It plowed into them with a slowness that seemed implacable and somehow grand. Tommy Wanamaker swore in the Indian head the next day that the taillights never flashed once. The Chevy just kept coming at a steady 15 or so, like the pace car in the Tournament of Roses parade. The undercarriage screeched over the concrete island, and when the wheels hit it, everyone but Stu saw the driver's head swing limply forward and strike the windshield, starring the glass. The Chevy jumped like an old dog that had been kicked and plowed away the high test pump. It snapped off and rolled away, spilling a few dribbles of gas. The nozzle came unhooked and lay gleaming under the fluorescence. They all saw the sparks produced by the Chevy's exhaust pipe grating across the cement, and Hap, who had seen a gas station explosion in Mexico, instinctively shielded his eyes against the fireball he expected. Instead, the Chevy's rear end flirted around and fell off the pump island on the station side. The front end smashed into the low lead pump, knocking it off with a hollow bang. Almost deliberately, the Chevrolet finished its 360-degree turn, hitting the island again, broadside this time. The rear end popped up on the island and knocked the regular gas pump asprawl. And there the Chevy came to rest, trailing its rusty exhaust pipe behind it. It had destroyed all three of the gas pumps on that island nearest the highway. The motor continued to run choppily for a few seconds and then quit. The silence was so loud it was alarming. Holy moly, Tommy Wanamaker said breathlessly. Will she blow, Hap? If it was gonna, it already woulda, Hap said, getting up. His shoulder bumped the map case, scattering Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona every which way. Hap felt a cautious sort of jubilation. His pumps were insured, and the insurance was paid up. Mary had harped on the insurance ahead of everything. Guy must be pretty drunk, Norm said. I've seen his taillights, Tommy said, his voice high with excitement. They never flashed once. Holy moly! If he'd been doing 60, we'd all be dead now. They hurried out of the office, Hap first and Stu bringing up the rear. Hap, Tommy, and Norm reached the car together. They could smell gas and hear the slow, clock-like tick of the Chevy's cooling engine. Hap opened the driver's side door, and the man behind the wheel spilled out like an old laundry sack. God damn! Norm Brouette shouted, almost screamed. He turned away, clutched his ample belly, and was sick. It wasn't the man who had fallen out. Hap had caught him neatly before he could thump to the pavement. But the smell that was issuing from the car, a sick stench compounded of blood, fecal matter, vomit, and human decay. It was a ghastly, rich, sick, dead smell. A moment later, Hap turned away, dragging the driver by the armpits. Tommy hastily grabbed the dragging feet, and he and Hap carried him into the office. In the glow of the overhead fluorescence, their faces were cheesy-looking and revolted. Hap had forgotten about his insurance money. The others looked into the car, and then Hank turned away, one hand over his mouth, little finger sticking off like a man who's just raised his wine glass to make a toast. He trotted to the north end of the station's lot and let his supper come up. Vic and Stu looked into the car for some time, looked at each other, and then looked back in. On the passenger side was a young woman, her shift dress hiked up high on her thighs. Leaning against her was a boy or girl, about 3 years old. They were both dead. Their necks had swelled up like inner tubes, and the flesh there was a purple-black color, like a bruise. The flesh was puffed up under their eyes, too. They looked, Vic later said, like those baseball players who put lampblack under their eyes to cut the glare. Their eyes bulged sightlessly. The woman was holding the child's hand. Thick mucus had run from their noses and was now clotted there. Flies buzzed around them, lighting in the mucus, crawling in and out of their open mouths. Stu had been in the war, but he had never seen anything so terribly pitiful as this. His eyes were constantly drawn back to those linked hands. He and Vic backed away and looked blankly at each other. Then they turned to the station. They could see Hap jawing frantically into the payphone. Norm was walking toward the station behind them, throwing glances at the wreck over his shoulder. The Chev's driver's side door stood sadly open. There was a pair of baby shoes dangling from the rearview mirror. Hank was standing by the door, rubbing his mouth with a dirty handkerchief. "Jesus, Stu," he said unhappily, and Stu nodded. Hap hung up the phone. The Chev's driver was lying on the floor. "Ambulance will be here in 10 minutes. Do you figure they're..." He jerked his thumb at the Chevy. "They're dead okay," Vic nodded. His lined face was yellow pale, and he was sprinkling tobacco all over the floor as he tried to make one of his shitty-smelling cigarettes. "They're the two deadest people I've ever seen." He looked at Stu, and Stu nodded, putting his hands in his pockets. He had the butterflies. The man on the floor moaned thickly in his throat, and they all looked down at him. After a moment, when it became obvious that the man was speaking or trying very hard to speak, Hap knelt beside him. It was, after all, his station. Whatever had been wrong with the woman and child in the car was also wrong with the man. His nose was running freely, and his respiration had a peculiar undersea sound, a churning from somewhere in his chest. The flesh beneath his eyes was puffing, not black yet, but a bruised purple. His neck looked too thick, and the flesh had pushed up in a column to give him two extra chins. He was running a high fever. Being close to him was like squatting on the edge of an open barbecue pit where good coals have been laid.
"The dog," he muttered. "Did you put him out?"
"Mister," Hap said, shaking him gently, "I called the ambulance. You're going to be all right."
"Somebody's got the books,"
the man on the floor grunted, and then began to cough, racking, chain-like explosions that sent heavy mucus spraying from his mouth in long and ropey splatters. Hap leaned backward, grimacing desperately.
"Better roll him over," Vic said. "He's going to choke on it."
But before they could, the coughing tapered off into bellows, uneven breathing again. His eyes blinked slowly, and he looked at the men gathered above him.
"Where's this?"
"Arnett," Hap said. "Bill Hapscom's Texaco. You crashed out some of my pumps." And then hastily he added, "That's okay, they was insured."
The man on the floor tried to sit up and was unable. He had to settle for putting a hand on Hap's arm.
"My wife, my little girl."
"They're fine," Hap said, grinning a foolish dog grin.
"Seems like I'm awful sick," the man said.
Breath came in and out of him in a thick, soft roar.
"They were sick, too, since we got up 2 days ago. Tahoe."
His eyes flickered, slowly closed.
"Sick. Guess we didn't move quick enough after all."
Far off, but getting closer, they could hear the whoop of the Arnett volunteer ambulance.
Man, Tommy Wanamaker said. Oh, man.
The sick man's eyes fluttered open again, and now they were filled with an intense, sharp concern. He struggled again to sit up. Sweat ran down his face. He grabbed Hap.
Are Sally and Levon all right? He demanded.
Spittle flew from his lips, and Hap could feel the man's burning heat radiating outward. The man was sick, half crazy. He stank. Hap was reminded of the smell an old dog blanket gets sometimes.
They're all right, he insisted a little frantically. You just lay down and take it easy, okay?
The man lay back down. His breathing was rougher now. Hap and Hank helped roll him over on his side, and his respiration seemed to ease a trifle.
I felt okay until last night, he said. Woke up with it in the night. Didn't get away quick enough. Is baby Levon okay?
This last trailed off into something none of them could make out. The ambulance siren warbled closer and closer. Stu went over to the window to watch for it. The others remained in a circle around the man on the floor.
What's he got, Vic? Any idea?
Hap asked. Vic shook his head.
Dunno. Might have been something they ate, Norm Bruett said. That car's got a California plate. They was probably eating a lot of roadside stands, you know. Maybe they got a poison hamburger. It happens.
The ambulance pulled in and skirted the wrecked Chevy to stop between it and the station door. The red light on top made crazy sweeping circles. It was full dark now.
Give me your hand and I'll pull you up out of there,
the man on the floor cried suddenly, and then was silent.
Food poisoning, Vic said. Yeah, that could be. I hope so, because...
Because what? Hank asked.
Because otherwise it might be something catching.
Vic looked at them with troubled eyes.
I seen cholera back in 1948 down in Nogales, and it looked something like this.
Three men came in wheeling a stretcher.
Hap, one of them said. You're lucky you didn't get your scourgy old ass blown to Kingdom Come. This guy, huh?
They broke apart to let them through. Billy Verrecker, Monty Sullivan, Carlos Ortega, men they all knew.
There's two folks in that car, Hap said, drawing Monty aside. Woman and little girl, both dead. Holy crow, you sure? Yeah, this guy, he don't know. You gonna take him to Braintree?
I guess, Monty looked at him, bewildered.
What do I do with the two in the car? I don't know how to handle this, Hap. Stu can call the state patrol. You mind if I ride in with you?
Hell no. They got the sick man under the stretcher, and while they ran him out, Hap went over to Stu.
I'm going to ride into Braintree with that guy. Would you call the state patrol?
Sure.
And Mary, too, call and tell her what happened.
Okay. Hap trotted out to the ambulance and climbed in. Billy Verrecker shut the doors behind him and then called the other two. They had been staring into the wrecked Chevy with dread fascination. A few moments later, the ambulance pulled out, siren warbling, red dome light pulsing blood shadows across the station's tarmac. Stu went to the phone and put a dime in. The man from the Chevy died 20 miles from the hospital. He drew one final bubbling gasp, let it out, hitched in a smaller one, and just quit. Hap got the man's wallet out of his hip pocket and looked at it. There was $17 in cash. A California driver's license identified him as Charles D. Campion. There was an army card and pictures of his wife and daughter encased in plastic. Hap didn't want to look at the pictures. He stuffed the wallet back into the dead man's pocket and told Carlos to turn off the siren. It was 9:10. Chapter 2. There was a long rock pier running out into the Atlantic Ocean from the Ogunquit, Maine town beach. Today it reminded her of an accusatory gray finger, and when Franny Goldsmith parked her car in the public lot, she could see Jess sitting out at the end of it, just a silhouette in the afternoon sunlight. Gulls wheeled and cried above him, a New England portrait drawn in real life, and she doubted if any gull would dare spoil it by dropping a splat of white doo-doo on Jess Ryder's immaculate blue chambray work shirt. After all, he was a practicing poet.
She knew it was Jess because his 10-speed was bolted to the iron railing that ran behind the parking attendant's building. Gus, a balding, paunchy town fixture, was coming out to meet her. The fee for visitors was $1 a car, but he knew Franny lived in town without bothering to look at the resident sticker on the corner of her Volvo's windshield. Fran came here a lot. Sure I do, Fran thought. In fact, I got pregnant right down there on the beach, just about 12 feet above the high tide line. Dear Lump, you were conceived on the scenic coast of Maine, 12 feet above the high tide line and 20 yards east of the seawall. X marks the spot. Gus raised his hand toward her, making a peace sign. Your fella's out on the end of the pier, Miss Goldsmith. Thanks, Gus. How's business? He waved smilingly at the parking lot. There were maybe 24 cars in all, and she could see blue and white resident stickers on most of them. Not much trade this early, he said. It was June 17th. Wait 2 weeks and we'll make the town some money. I'll bet, if you don't embezzle it all. Gus laughed and went back inside. Franny leaned one arm on the warm metal of her car, took off her sneakers, and put on a pair of rubber thongs. She was a tall girl with chestnut hair that fell halfway down the back of the buff-colored shift she was wearing. Good figure, long legs that got appreciative glances. Prime stuff was the correct frat house term, she believed. Looky, 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 here comes Nookie. Miss College Girl, 1980. Then she had to laugh at herself, and the laugh was only a trifle bitter. You were carrying on, she told herself, as if this were the news of the world. Chapter 6. Hester brings the news of Pearl's impending arrival to Reverend Dimmesdale. Dimmesdale he wasn't. He was Jess Ryder, age 20, 1 year younger than our heroine, little Fran. He was a practicing college student undergraduate poet. You could tell by his immaculate blue chambray work shirt. She paused at the edge of the sand, feeling the good heat baking the soles of her feet even through the rubber thongs. The silhouette at the far end of the pier was still tossing small rocks into the water. Her thought was partly amusing, but mostly dismaying. He knows what he looks like out there, she thought. Lord Byron, lonely but unafraid, sitting in lonely solitude and surveying the sea which leads back to where England lies. But I, an exile, may never... Oh, balls! It wasn't so much the thought that disturbed her as what it indicated about her own state of mind. The young man she assumed she loved was sitting out there, and she was standing here caricaturing him behind his back. She began to walk out along the pier, picking her way with careful grace over the rocks and crevices. It was an old pier, once part of a breakwater. Now most of the boats tied up on the southern end of the town, where there were 3 marinas and 7 honky-tonk motels that boomed all summer long. She walked slowly, trying her best to cope with the thought that she might have fallen out of love with him in the space of the 11 days that she had known she was a little bit preggers, in the words of Amy Lauder. Well, he had gotten her into that condition, hadn't he? But not alone, that was for sure. And she had been on the pill. That had been the simplest thing in the world. She'd gone to the campus infirmary, told the doctor she was having painful menstruation and all sorts of embarrassing eructations on her skin, and the doctor had written her a prescription. In fact, he had given her a month of freebies. She stopped again, out over the water now, the waves beginning to break toward the beach on her right and left. It occurred to her that the infirmary doctors probably heard about painful menstruation and too many pimples about as often as druggists heard about how I gotta buy these condoms for my brother, even more often in this day and age. She could just as easily have gone to him and said, "Give me the pill, I'm gonna fuck." She was of age, why be coy? She looked at Jesse's back and sighed. Because coyness gets to be a way of life. She began to walk again. Anyway, the pill hadn't worked. Somebody in the quality control department at the jolly old Overill factory had been asleep at the switch. Either that or she'd forgotten a pill and then had forgotten she'd forgotten. She walked softly up behind him and laid both hands on his shoulders. Jess, who had been holding his rocks in his left hand and plunking them into Mother Atlantic with his right, let out a scream and lurched to his feet. Pebbles scattered everywhere, and he almost knocked Franny off the side and into the water. He almost went in himself, head first. She started to giggle helplessly and backed away with her hands over her mouth as he turned furiously around,
a well-built young man with black hair, gold-rimmed glasses, and regular features which, to Jess's eternal discomfort, would never quite reflect the sensitivity inside him. "You scared the hell out of me," he roared. "Oh, Jess," she giggled. "Oh, Jess, I'm sorry, but that was funny. It really was." "We almost fell in the water," he said, taking a resentful step toward her. She took a step backward to compensate, tripped over a rock, and sat down hard. Her jaws clicked together hard with her tongue between them, exquisite pain, and she stopped giggling as if the sound had been cut off with a knife. The very fact of her sudden silence, "You turn me off, I'm a radio," seemed funniest of all, and she began to giggle again in spite of the fact that her tongue was bleeding and tears of pain were streaming from her eyes. "Are you okay, Franny?" He knelt beside her, concerned. "I do love him," she thought with some relief. "Good thing for me." "Did you hurt yourself, Fran?" "Only my pride," she said, letting him help her up. "And I bit my tongue, see?" She ran it out for him, expecting to get a smile as a reward, but he frowned. "Jesus, Fran, you're really bleeding." He pulled a handkerchief out of his back pocket and looked at it doubtfully. Then he put it back. The image of the two of them walking hand in hand back to the parking lot came to her. Young lovers under a summer sun, her with his handkerchief stuffed in her mouth. She raises her hand to the smiling, benevolent attendant and says, "Hong hoggigo." She began to giggle again, even though her tongue did hurt and there was a bloody taste in her mouth that was a little nauseating. "Look the other way," she said primly. "I'm going to be unladylike." Smiling a little, he theatrically covered his eyes. Propped on one arm, she stuck her head off the side of the pier and spat, bright red. "Ugh," again and again. At last her mouth seemed to clear, and she looked around to see him peeking through his fingers. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm such an asshole." "No," Jesse said, obviously meaning yes. "Could we go get some ice cream?" she asked. "You drive, I'll buy." "That's a deal." He got to his feet and helped her up. She spat over the side again, bright red. Apprehensively, Fran asked him, "I didn't bite any of it off, did I?" "I don't know," Jess answered pleasantly. "Did you swallow a lump?" She put a revolted hand to her mouth. "That's not funny." "No, I'm sorry. You just bit it, Franny." "Are there any arteries in a person's tongue?" They were walking back along the pier now, hand in hand. She paused every now and then to spit over the side. Bright red. She wasn't going to swallow any of that stuff. Uh-uh, no way. "Nope." "Good." She squeezed his hand and smiled at him reassuringly. "I'm pregnant." "Really? That's good. Do you know who I saw in Port..." He stopped and looked at her, his face suddenly inflexible and very, very careful. It broke her heart a little to see that wariness there. "What did you say?" "I'm pregnant." She smiled at him brightly and then spat over the side of the pier, bright red. "Big joke, Franny," he said uncertainly. "No joke." He kept looking at her. After a while, they started walking again. As they crossed the parking lot, Gus came out and waved to them. Franny waved back. So did Jess. They stopped at the Dairy Queen on US 1. Jess got a Coke and sat sipping it thoughtfully behind the Volvo's wheel. Fran made him get her a Banana Boat Supreme, and she sat against her door, 2 feet of seat between them, spooning up nuts and pineapple sauce and ersatz Dairy Queen ice cream. "You know," she said, "DQ ice cream is mostly bubbles. Did you know that? Lots of people don't." Jess looked at her and said nothing. "Truth," she said. "Those ice cream machines are really nothing but giant bubble machines. That's how Dairy Queen can sell their ice cream so cheap. We had an off-print about it in Business Theory. There are many ways to defer a feline." Jess looked at her and said nothing. "Now, if you want real ice cream, you have to go to someplace like a Deering ice cream shop, and that's..." She burst into tears. He slid across the seat to her and put his arms around her neck. "Franny, don't do that, please." "My banana boat is dripping on me," she said, still weeping. His handkerchief came out again, and he mopped her off. By then, her tears had trailed off to sniffles. Banana boat supreme with blood sauce, she said, looking at him with red eyes. I guess I can't eat any more. I'm sorry, Jess. Would you throw it away?
Sure, he said stiffly.
He took it from her, got out, and tossed it in the waste can. He was walking funny, Fran thought, as if he had been hit hard down low where it hurts boys. In a way, she supposed that was just where he had been hit. But if he wanted to look at it another way, well, that was just about the way she had walked after he had taken her virginity on the beach. She had felt like she had a bad case of diaper rash. Only diaper rash doesn't make you preggers. He came back and got in. Are you really Fran? He asked abruptly. I am, really. How did it happen? I thought you were on the pill. Well, what I figure is, somebody in the quality control department of the jolly old Overall factory was asleep at the switch when my batch of pills went by on the conveyor belt, or two, they are feeding you guys something in the UNH mess hall that builds up sperm, or three, I forgot to take a pill, and have since forgotten I forgot. She offered him a hard, thin, sunny smile that he recoiled from just a bit. What are you mad about, Fran? I just asked. Well, to answer your question in a different way, on a warm night in April, it must have been the 12th, 13th, or 14th, you put your penis into my vagina and had an orgasm, thus ejaculating sperm by the millions. Stop it, he said sharply. You don't have to... To what? Outwardly stony, she was dismayed inside. In all her imaginings of how the scene might play, she had never seen it quite like this. To be so mad, he said lamely. I'm not going to run out on you. No, she said more softly. At this point, she could have plucked one of his hands off the wheel, held it, and healed the breach entirely. But she couldn't make herself do it. He had no business wanting to be comforted, no matter how tacit or unconscious his wanting was. She suddenly realized that, one way or another, the laughs and the good times were over for a while. That made her want to cry again, and she staved the tears off grimly. She was Franny Goldsmith, Peter Goldsmith's daughter, and she wasn't going to sit in the parking lot of an Algonquin Dairy Queen crying her damn stupid eyes out. What do you want to do? Jess asked, getting out his cigarettes. What do you want to do? He struck a light, and for just a moment, as cigarette smoke raftered up, she saw clearly a man and a boy fighting for control of the same face. Oh, hell, he said. The choices as I see them, she said, we can get married and keep the baby. We can get married and give the baby up. Or we don't get married and I keep the baby. Or, Franny. Or, we don't get married and I don't keep the baby. Or I could get an abortion. Does that cover everything? Have I left anything out? Franny, can't we just talk? We are talking, she flashed at him. You had your chance and you said, oh, hell, your exact words. I have just outlined all of the possible choices. Of course, I've had a little more time to work up an agenda. You want a cigarette? No, they're bad for the baby. Franny, goddammit! Why are you shouting? She asked softly. Because you seem determined to aggravate me as much as you can, Jess said hotly. He controlled himself. I'm sorry, I just can't think of this as my fault. You can't? She looked at him with a cocked eyebrow. And behold, a virgin shall conceive. Do you have to be so goddamn flip? You had the pill, you said. I took you at your word. Was I so wrong? No, you weren't so wrong. But that doesn't change the fact. I guess not, he said gloomily, and pitched his cigarette out half-smoked. So what do we do? You keep asking me, Jesse. I just outlined the choices as I see them. I thought you might have some ideas. There's suicide, but I'm not considering it at this point. So pick the other choice you like and we'll talk about it. Let's get married, he said in a sudden strong voice. He had the air of a man who has decided that the best way to solve the Gordian knot problem would be to hack right down through the middle of it. Full speed ahead and get the whiners below decks. No, she said. I don't want to marry you. It was as if his face was held together by a number of unseen bolts, and each of them had suddenly been loosened a turn and a half. Everything sagged at once. The image was so cruelly comical that she had to rub her wounded tongue against the rough top of her mouth to keep from getting the giggles again. She didn't want to laugh at Jess. Why not?
he asked.
Fran, I have to think of my reasons why not. I'm not going to let you draw me into a discussion of my reasons why not, because right now I don't know.
You don't love me, he said sulkily.
In most cases, love and marriage are mutually exclusive states. Pick another choice.
He was silent for a long time. He fiddled with a fresh cigarette, but he didn't light it. At last he said,
I can't pick another choice, Franny, because you don't want to discuss this. You want to score points off me.
That touched her a little. She nodded.
Maybe you're right. I've had a few scored off me in the last couple of weeks.
Now, you, Jess, you're a Joe College all the way. If a mugger came at you with a knife, you'd want to convene a seminar on the spot.
Oh, for God's sake.
Pick another choice.
No, you've got all your responses figured out. Maybe I need a little time to think, too.
Okay, would you take us back to the parking lot? I'll drop you off and do some errands.
He gazed at her, startled.
Franny, I rode my bike all the way down from Portland. I've got a room at a motel outside of town. I thought we were going to spend the weekend together.
In your motel room, no doubt. No, Jess, the situation has changed. You just get back on your 10-speed and bike back to Portland, and you get in touch when you've thought about it a little more. No great hurry.
Stop riding me, Franny.
No, Jess, you were the one who rode me, she jeered in sudden furious anger, and that was when he slapped her lightly backhand on the cheek.
He stared at her, stunned.
I'm sorry, Fran.
Accepted, she said colorlessly.
Drive on.
They didn't talk on the ride back to the public beach parking lot. She sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching the slices of ocean layered between the cottages just west of the seawall. They looked like slum apartments, she thought. Who owned these houses, most of them still shuttered blindly against the summer that would begin officially in less than a week? Professors from MIT, Boston doctors, New York lawyers. These houses weren't the real biggies, the coast estates owned by men who counted their fortunes in 7 and 8 figures. But when the families who owned them moved in here, the lowest IQ on Shore Road would be Gus the parking attendant. The kids would have 10-speeds like Jess's. They would have bored expressions, and they would go with their parents to have lobster dinners and to attend the Ogunquit Playhouse. They would idle up and down the main street, masquerading after soft summer twilight as street people. She kept looking out at the lovely flashes of cobalt between the crammed together houses, aware that the vision was blurring with a new film of tears, the little white cloud that cried. They reached the parking lot, and Gus waved. They waved back.
I'm sorry I hit you, Franny, Jess said in a subdued voice. I never meant to do that.
I know.
Are you going back to Portland?
I'll stay here tonight and call you in the morning. But it's your decision, Fran. If you decide, you know, that an abortion is the thing, I'll scrape up the cash.
Pun intended?
No, he said. Not at all.
He slid across the seat and kissed her chastely.
I love you, Fran.
I don't believe you do, she thought. Suddenly, I don't believe it at all, but I'll accept it in good grace. I can do that much.
All right, she said quietly.
It's the Lighthouse Motel. Call if you want.
Okay.
She slid behind the wheel, suddenly feeling very tired. Her tongue ached miserably where she had bitten it. He walked to where his bike was locked to the iron railing and coasted it back to her.
Wish you'd call, Fran.
She smiled artificially.
We'll see. So long, Jess.
She put the Volvo in gear, turned around, and drove across the lot to the shore road. She could see Jess standing by his bike yet, the ocean at his back, and for the second time that day she mentally accused him of knowing exactly what kind of picture he was making. This time, instead of being irritated, she felt a little bit sad. She drove on, wondering if the ocean would ever look the way it had looked to her before all of this had happened. Her tongue hurt miserably. She opened her window wider and spat. All white and all right this time. She could smell the salt of the ocean strongly, like bitter tears. Chapter 3
Norm Bruette woke up at 10:15 in the morning to the sound of kids fighting outside the bedroom window and country music from the radio in the kitchen. He went to the back door in his saggy shorts and undershirt, threw it open, and yelled, "You kids, shut your heads!" A moment's pause. Luke and Bobby looked around from the old and rusty dump truck they'd been arguing over. As always when he saw his kids, Norm felt dragged two ways at once. His heart ached to see them wearing hand-me-downs and Salvation Army give-outs, like the ones you saw the nigger children in East Arnett wearing. And at the same time, a horrible, shaking anger would sweep through him, making him want to stride out there and beat the living shit out of them. "Yes, Daddy," Luke said in a subdued way. He was 9. "Yes, Daddy," Bobby echoed. He was 7 going on 8. Norm stood for a moment, glaring at them, and slammed the door shut. He stood for a moment, looking indecisively at the pile of clothes he had worn yesterday. They were lying at the foot of the saggy double bed where he had dropped them. "That slutty bitch," he thought. "She didn't even hang up my duds." "Lila!" he bawled. There was no answer. He considered ripping the door open again and asking Luke where the hell she had gone. It wasn't Donated Commodities Day until next week, and if she was down at the employment office in Braintree again, she was an even bigger fool than he thought. He didn't bother to ask the kids. He felt tired, and he had a queasy, thumping headache. Felt like a hangover, but he'd only had 3 beers down at Haps the night before. That accident had been a hell of a thing. The woman and the baby dead in the car, the man Campion dying on the way to the hospital. By the time Hap had gotten back, the state patrol had come and gone, and the wrecker and the Braintree undertaker's hack. Vic Palfrey had given the state patrols a statement for all 5 of them. The undertaker, who was also the county coroner, refused to speculate on what might have hit them. "But it ain't cholera, and don't you go scaring people saying it is. There'll be an autopsy, and you can read about it in the paper." Miserable little pissant, Norm thought, slowly dressing himself in yesterday's clothes. His headache was turning into a real blinder. Those kids had better be quiet, or they were going to have a pair of broken arms to mouth off about. Why the hell couldn't they have school the whole year round? He considered tucking his shirt into his pants, decided the president probably wouldn't be stopping by that day, and shuffled out into the kitchen in his sock feet. The bright sunlight coming in the east windows made him squint. The cracked Philco radio over the stove sang, "But baby, you can tell me if anyone can. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Tell me, baby, can you dig your man?" Things had come to a pretty pass when they had to play nigger rock and roll music like that on the local country music station. Norm turned it off before it could split his head. There was a note by the radio, and he picked it up, squinting his eyes to read it. "Dear Norm, Sally Hodges says she needs somebody to sit her kids this morning and says she'll give me $1. I'll be back for lunch. There's sausage if you want it. I love you, honey. Lila." Norm put the note back and just stood there for a moment, thinking it over and trying to get the sense of it in his mind. It was goddamn hard to think past the headache. Babysitting. $1. For Ralph Hodges' wife. The 3 elements slowly gelled together in his mind. Lila had gone off to sit Sally Hodges' 3 kids to earn a lousy $1 and had stuck him with Luke and Bobby. By God, it was hard times when a man had to sit home and wipe his kids' noses so his wife could go and scratch out a lousy buck that would give them back pocket change from a gallon of gas. That was hard fucking times. Dull anger came to him, making his head ache even worse. He shuffled slowly to the Frigidaire, bought when he had been making good overtime, and opened it. Most of the shelves were empty, except for leftovers Lila had put up in refrigerator dishes. He hated those little plastic Tupperware dishes, old beans, old corn, a leftover dab of chili. Nothing a man liked to eat. Nothing in there but little Tupperware dishes and 3 little old sausages done up in handy wrap. He bent, looking in at them, the familiar helpless anger now compounded by the dull throb in his head. He didn't feel like eating anyway. He felt damn sick when he got right down to it. He went over to the stove, scratched a match on the piece of sandpaper nailed to the wall beside it, lit the front gas ring, and put on the coffee. Then he sat down and waited dully for it to boil. Just before it did, he had to scramble his snot rag out of his back pocket to catch a big wet sneeze. Coming down with a cold, he thought. Isn't that something nice on top of everything else? But it never occurred to him to think of the phlegm that had been running out of that fellow Campion's nose the night before. Hap was in the garage bay, putting a new tailpipe on Tony Leominster's Scout, and Vic Palfrey was sitting on a folding camp chair, watching him and drinking a Dr. Pepper, when the bell dinged out front. Vic squinted.
"It's the state patrol," he said. "Looks like your cousin there, Joe Bob." "Okay."
Hap came out from beneath the Scout, wiping his hands on a ball of waste. On his way through the office, he sneezed heavily. He hated summer colds. They were the worst. Joe Bob, who was almost 6.5 feet tall, was standing by the back of his cruiser, filling up. Beyond him, the three pumps Campion had driven over the night before were neatly lined up like dead soldiers.
"Hey, Joe Bob," Hap said, coming out.
"Hap, you some bitch,"
Joe Bob said, putting the pump handle on automatic and stepping over the hose.
"You're lucky this place is still standing this morning."
"Shit, Stu Redmond saw this guy coming and switched off the pumps. There was a load of sparks, though."
"Still damn lucky. Listen, Hap, I come over for something besides a fill-up."
"Yeah?"
Joe Bob's eyes went to Vic, who was standing in the station door.
"Was that old geezer here last night?"
"Who, Vic? Yeah, he comes over almost every night."
"Can he keep his mouth shut?"
"Sure, I reckon. He's a good enough old boy."
The automatic feed kicked off. Hap squeezed off another 20 cents worth, then put the nozzle back on the pump and switched it off. He walked back to Joe Bob.
"So, what story?"
"Well, let's go inside. I guess the old fella ought to hear, too. And if you get a chance, you can phone the rest of them that was here."
They walked across the tarmac and into the office.
"Morning to you, officer," Vic said.
Joe Bob nodded.
"Coffee, Joe Bob?" Hap asked.
"I guess not."
He looked at them heavily.
"The thing is, I don't know how my superiors would like me being here at all. So when those guys come here, you don't let them know I tipped you, right?"
"What guys, officer?" Vic asked.
"Health department guys," Joe Bob said.
Vic said,
"Oh, Jesus, it was cholera. I knew it was."
Hap looked from one to the other.
"Joe Bob?"
"I don't know nothing,"
Joe Bob said, sitting down in one of the plastic Woolco chairs. His bony knees came up nearly to his neck. He took a pack of Chesterfields from his blouse pocket and lit up.
"Finnegan there, the coroner."
"That was a smartass," Hap said fiercely. "You should have seen him strutting in here, Joe Bob, shushing people and all that."
"He's a big turd in a little bowl, all right," Joe Bob agreed.
"Well, he got Dr. James to look at this Campion, and the two of them called in another doctor that I don't know. Then they got on the phone to Houston, and around 3 this morning they come into that little airport outside of Braintree."
"Who did?"
"Pathologists, 3 of them. They were in there with the body until about 8 o'clock. Then they got on the phone to the plague center in Atlanta, and those guys are going to be here this afternoon. But they said in the meantime that the health department was to get out here and see all the guys that were in the station last night and the guys that drove the rescue unit to Braintree. I don't know, but it sounds to me like they want you quarantined."
"Jesus," Hap said, frightened.
"The Atlanta Plague Center's federal," Vic said. "Would they send out a plane load of federal men just for cholera?"
"Search me," Joe Bob said. "But I thought you guys had a right to know. From all I heard, you just tried to lend a hand."
"It's appreciated, Joe Bob," Hap said slowly. "What did James and this other doctor say?"
"Not much, but they looked scared.
I never seen doctors look scared like that. I didn't much care for it."
A heavy silence fell. Joe Bob went to the drink machine and got a bottle of Fresca. The faint hissing sound of carbonation was audible as he popped the cap. As Joe Bob sat down again, Hap took a Kleenex from the box next to the cash register, wiped his runny nose, and folded it into the pocket of his greasy coverall.
"What have you found out about Campion?" Vic asked. "Anything?"
"We're still checking," Joe Bob said with a trace of importance. "His ID says he was from San Diego, but a lot of the stuff in his wallet was 2 and 3 years out of date. His driver's license was expired. He had a Bank AmeriCard that was issued in 1976, and that was expired, too. He had an army card, so we're checking with them. The captain has a hunch that Campion hadn't lived in San Diego for maybe 4 years. AWOL? Vic asked. He produced a big red bandana, hawked and spat into it. Don't know yet, Joe Bob said. But his army card said he was in until 1982, and he was in civvies, and he was with his family, and he was a fuck of a long way from California, and listen to my mouth run. Well, I'll get in touch with the others and tell them what you said anyway, Hap said. Much obliged. Joe Bob stood up. Sure, just keep my name out of it. I sure wouldn't want to lose my job. Your buddies don't need to know who tipped you, do they? No, Hap said, and Vic echoed it. As Joe Bob went to the door, Hap said a little apologetically, That's five even for gas, Joe Bob. I hate to charge you, but with things the way they are, that's okay. Joe Bob handed him a credit card. State's paying, and I got my credit slip to show why I was here. While Hap was filling out the slip, he sneezed twice. You won't watch that, Joe Bob said. Nothing any worse than a summer cold. Don't I know it, Hap said. Suddenly, from behind them, Vic said, Maybe it ain't a cold. They turned to him. Vic looked frightened. I woke up this morning sneezing and hacking away like 60, Vic said. Had a mean headache, too. It's gone back some, but I'm still full of snot. Maybe we're coming down with it. What that Campion had, what he died of. Hap looked at him for a long time, and as he was about to put forward all his reasons why it couldn't be, he sneezed again. Joe Bob looked at them both gravely for a moment, and then said, You know, it might not be such a bad idea to close the station, Hap, just for the day. Hap looked at him, scared, and tried to remember what all his reasons had been. He couldn't think of a one. All he could remember was that he had also awakened with a headache and a runny nose. Well, everyone caught a cold once in a while. But before that guy Campion had shown up, he had been fine. Just fine. The three Hodges kids were 6, 4, and 18 months. The two youngest were taking naps, and the oldest was out back digging a hole. Lila Bruette was in the living room watching the doctors. She hoped Sally wouldn't return until it was all over. Ralph had bought a big color TV when times had been better in Arnett, and Lila loved to watch the afternoon stories in color. Everything was so much prettier. She drew on her cigarette and then let the smoke out in spasms as a racking cough seized her. She went into the kitchen and spat the mouthful of crap she had brought up down the drain. She had gotten up with the cough, and all day it had felt like someone was tickling the back of her throat with a feather. She went back to the living room after taking a peek out the pantry window to make sure Bert Hodges was okay. A commercial was on now, two dancing bottles of toilet bowl cleaner. Lila let her eyes drift around the room and wished her own house looked this nice. Sally's hobby was doing paint-by-the-numbers pictures of Christ, and they were all over the living room in nice frames. She especially liked the big one of the Last Supper mounted on the back of the TV. It had come with 60 different oil colors, Sally had told her, and it took almost 3 months to finish. It was a real work of art. Just as the doctors came back on, baby Cheryl started to cry, a whooping, ugly yell that was broken by bursts of coughing. Lila put out her cigarette and hurried into the bedroom. Eva, the 4-year-old, was still fast asleep, but Cheryl was lying on her back in her crib, and her face was going an alarming purple color. Her cries began to sound strangled. Lila, who was not afraid of the croup after seeing both of her own through bouts with it, picked her up by the heels and swatted her firmly on the back. She had no idea if Dr. Spock recommended this sort of treatment or not, because she had never read him. It worked nicely on baby Cheryl. She emitted a froggy croak and suddenly spat an amazing wad of yellow phlegm out onto the floor. Better? Lila asked. Yes, said baby Cheryl. She was almost asleep again. Lila wiped up the mess with a Kleenex. She couldn't remember ever having seen a baby cough up so much snot all at once. She sat down in front of the doctors again, frowning. She lit another cigarette, sneezed over the first puff, and then began to cough. Yep. Chapter 4. It was an hour past nightfall. Starkey sat alone at a long table, sifting through sheets of yellow flimsy. Their contents dismayed him. He had been serving his country for 36 years, beginning as a scared West Point plebe. He had won medals. He had spoken with presidents, had offered them advice, and on occasion, his advice had been taken. He had been through dark moments before, plenty of them, but this. He was scared, so deeply scared he hardly dared admit it to himself. It was the kind of fear that could drive you mad. On impulse, he got up and went to the wall where the five blank TV monitors looked into the room. As he got up, his knee bumped the table, causing one of the sheets of flimsy to fall off the edge. It seesawed lazily down through the mechanically purified air and landed on the tile, half in the table's shadow and half out. Someone standing over it and looking down would have seen this. OT confirmed, seems reasonably, strain-coded 848AB, Campion, W, Sally, antigen shift and mutation, high-risk excess mortality, and communicability estimated, repeat, 99.4%. Atlanta Plague Center, understands. Top secret blue folder, ends. PT-222-312A. Starkey pushed a button under the middle screen, and the picture flashed on with the unnerving suddenness of solid-state components. It showed the Western California desert looking east. It was desolate, made even more eerie by the reddish tinge of infrared photography. It's out there, straight ahead, Starkey thought. Project Blue. The fright tried to wash over him again. He reached into his pocket and brought out a pink and yellow capsule, what his daughter would call a downer. Names didn't matter, results did. He dry-swallowed, his hard, unseamed face wrinkling for a moment as it went down. Project Blue. He looked at the other blank monitors and then punched up pictures on all of them. 4 and 5 showed labs. 4 was physics. 5 was viral biology. The Vi-Bi lab was full of animal cages, mostly for guinea pigs, rhesus monkeys, and a few dogs. All of them appeared to be sleeping. In the physics lab, a small centrifuge was still turning around and around. Starkey had complained about that. He had complained bitterly. There was something spooky about that centrifuge going around and around while Dr. Eswick lay dead on the floor nearby, sprawled out like a scarecrow that had tipped over in a high wind. They had explained to him that the centrifuge was on the same circuit as the lights, and if they turned off the centrifuge, the lights would go too. And the cameras down there were not equipped for infrared. Starkey understood. Some more brass might come down from Washington and want to look at the dead Nobel Prize winner who was lying 400 feet under the desert less than a mile away. If we turn off the centrifuge, we turn off the professor. Elementary. What his daughter would have called a catch-22. He took another downer and looked into monitor 2. This was the one he didn't like. He didn't like the man with his face in the soup. Suppose someone walked up to you and said, "You will spend eternity with your fizz in a bowl of soup." It's like the old pie-in-the-face routine. It stops being funny when it starts being you. Monitor 2 showed the Project Blue cafeteria. The accident had occurred almost perfectly between shifts, and the cafeteria had been only lightly populated. He supposed it hadn't mattered much to them, whether they had died in the cafeteria or in their bedrooms or their labs. Still, the man with his face in the soup. A man and a woman in blue coveralls were crumpled at the foot of the candy machine. A man in a white coverall lay beside the Seaburg jukebox. At the tables themselves were 9 men and 14 women, some of them slumped beside hostess Twinkies, some with spilled cups of Coke and bubble-up still clutched in their stiff hands. And at the second table, near the end, there was a man who had been identified as Frank D. Bruce, with his face in a bowl of what seemed to be Campbell's chunky sirloin soup. The first monitor showed only a digital clock. Until June 13th, all the numbers on that clock had been green. Now they had turned bright red. They had stopped. The figures read 06-13-80-02-3616. June 13th, 1980. 37 minutes past 2 o'clock in the morning and 16 seconds. From behind him came a brief burring noise. Starkey turned off the monitors one by one and then turned around.
He saw the sheet of flimsy on the floor and put it back on the table. Come. It was Carlsley. He looked grave and his skin was a slaty color. More bad news, Starkey thought serenely. Someone else has taken a long high dive into a cold bowl of chunky sirloin soup. Hi, Len, he said quietly. Len Carlsley nodded. Billy, Christ, I don't know how to tell you. I think one word at a time might go best, soldier. Those men who handled Campion's body are through their prelims at Atlanta, but the news isn't good. All of them? 5 for sure. There's one, his name is Stuart Redman, who's negative so far, but as far as we can tell, Campion himself was negative for over 50 hours. If only Campion hadn't run, Starkey said. That was sloppy security, Len. Very sloppy. Carlsley nodded. Go on. Arnett has been quarantined. We've isolated at least 16 cases of constantly shifting A-prime flu there so far, and those are just the overt ones. The news media? So far, no problem. They believe it's anthrax. What else? One very serious problem. We have a Texas highway patrolman named Joseph Robert Brentwood. His cousin owns the gas station where Campion touched down. He dropped by yesterday morning to tell Hapscombe the health people were coming. We picked Brentwood up 3 hours ago, and he's en route to Atlanta now. In the meantime, he's been patrolling half of East Texas. God knows how many people he's been in contact with. Oh, shit, Starkey said, and was appalled by the watery weakness in his voice and the skin crawl that had started near the base of his testicles and was now working up into his belly. 99.4% communicability, he thought. It played insanely over and over in his mind. And that meant 99.4% excess mortality, because the human body couldn't produce the antibodies necessary to stop a constantly shifting antigen virus. Every time the body did produce the right antibody, the virus simply shifted, for the same reason a vaccine was going to be almost impossible to create. 99.4%. Christ, he said. That's it? Well, go on, finish. Softly then, Carlsley said, Hammer's dead, Billy. Suicide. He shot himself in the eye with his service pistol. The Project Blue specs were on his desk. I guess he thought leaving them there was easier than writing a suicide note. Starkey closed his eyes. Vic Hammer was, had been, his son-in-law. How was he supposed to tell Cynthia about this? I'm sorry, Cindy. Vic took a high dive into a cold bowl of soup today. Here, have a downer. You see, there was a goof. Somebody made a mistake with a box. Somebody else forgot to pull a switch that would have sealed off the base. The lag was only 23 seconds, but it was enough. The box is known in the trade as a sniffer. It's made in Portland, Oregon, Defense Department contract 16448096. The boxes are put together by female technicians, and they're put together circuit by circuit, so none of them really know what they're doing. One of them was maybe thinking about what to make for supper, and whoever was supposed to check her work was maybe thinking about trading the family car. Anyway, Cindy, the last coincidence was that a man at the number 4 security post, a man named Campion, saw the numbers go red. He got his family and ran. He drove through the main gate just 23 seconds before the siren started going off. Anyway, Cindy, what I'm trying to say is that this was a chain of coincidence on the order of winning the Irish sweepstakes. None of it was Vic's fault, but he was the head of the project, and he saw the situation start to escalate, and then... Thanks, Len, he said. Billy, would you like... I'll be up in 10 minutes. I want you to schedule a general staff meeting 15 minutes from now. If they're in bed, kick them out. Yes, sir. And Len... Yes? I'm glad you were the one who told me. Yes, sir. Carlsley left. Starkey glanced at his watch, then walked over to the monitor set into the wall. He turned on 2, put his hands behind his back, and stared thoughtfully into Project Blue's silent cafeteria. Chapter 5. Larry Underwood pulled around the corner and found a parking space big enough for the Datsun Z between a fire hydrant and somebody's trash can that had fallen into the gutter.
There was something unpleasant in the trash can, and Larry tried to tell himself that he really hadn't seen the stiffening dead cat and the rat gnawing at its white-furred belly. The rat was gone so fast from the sweep of his headlights that it really might not have been there. The cat, however, was fixed in stasis, and, he supposed, killing the Z's engine. If you believed in one, you had to believe in the other. Didn't they say that Paris had the biggest rat population in the world? All those old sewers. But New York did well, too. And if he remembered his misspent youth well enough, not all the rats in New York City went on four legs. And what the hell was he doing parked in front of this decaying brownstone thinking about rats, anyway? 5 days ago, on June 14th, he had been in sunny Southern California, home of hopheads, freak religions, the only C&W nightclubs in the world with go-go dancers, and Disneyland. This morning at 4:15, he had arrived on the shore of the other ocean, paying his toll to go across the Triborough Bridge. A sullen drizzle had been falling. Only in New York can an early summer drizzle seem so unrepentantly sullen. Larry could see the drops accreting on the Z's windshield now, as intimations of dawn began to creep into the eastern sky. Dear New York, I've come home. Maybe the Yankees were in town. That might make the trip worthwhile. Take the subway up to the newly refurbished stadium, drink beer, eat hot dogs, and watch the Yankees wallop the piss out of Cleveland or Boston. His thoughts drifted off, and when he wandered back to them, he saw that the light had gotten much stronger. The dashboard clock read 6:05. He had been dozing. The rat was back, he saw. The rat had dug himself quite a hole in that dead cat's guts. Larry's empty stomach did a slow forward roll. He considered beeping the horn to scare it away for good, but the sleeping brownstones with their empty garbage cans standing sentinel duty daunted him. He slouched lower in the bucket seat so he wouldn't have to watch the rat eating breakfast. Just a bite, my good man, and then back to the subway system. Going out to Yankee Stadium this evening? Perhaps I'll see you, old chum, although I really doubt that you'll see me. The front of the building had been defaced with spray can slogans, cryptic and ominous. Chico 116, Zorro 93, Little Abe number 1. When he had been a boy, before his father died, this had been a good neighborhood. Two stone dogs had guarded the steps leading up to the double doors. A year before he took off for the coast, vandals had demolished the one on the right from the forepaws up. Now they were both gone entirely, except for one rear paw of the left dog. The body it had been called into creation to support was gone, perhaps decorating some Puerto Rican junkie's crash pad. Maybe Zorro 93 or Little Abe number 1 had taken it. Maybe the rats had carried it away to some deserted subway tunnel one dark night. For all he knew, maybe they had taken his mother along, too. He supposed he should at least climb the steps and make sure her name was still there under the apartment 15 mailbox. But he was too tired. No, he would just sit here and nod off, trusting to the last residue of the reds in his system to wake him up around 7. Then he would go see if his mother still lived here. Maybe it would be best if she was gone. Maybe then he wouldn't even bother with the Yankees. Maybe he'd just check into the Biltmore, sleep for 3 days, and then head back into the Golden West. In this light, in this drizzle, with his legs and head still throbbing from the bring down, New York looked like a dead whore. His mind began to drift away again, mulling over the last 9 weeks or so, still trying to find some sort of key that would make everything clear, and explain how you could butt yourself against stone walls for 6 long years, playing the clubs, making the demo tapes, doing sessions, the whole thing, and then suddenly make it in 9 weeks. Trying to get that straight in your mind was like trying to swallow a doorknob. There had to be an answer, he thought, an explanation that would allow him to reject the ugly notion that the whole thing had been a whim, a simple twist of fate, in Dylan's words. He dozed deeper, arms crossed on his chest, going over it, and mixed up through all of it was this new thing, like a low and sinister counterpoint, one note at the threshold of audibility played on a synthesizer, heard in a migrainy sort of way that acted on you like a premonition. The rat digging into the dead cat's body, munch, munch, just looking for something tasty here. It's the law of the jungle, my man. If you're in the trees, you got to swing.
It had really started 18 months ago. He had been playing with the tattered remnants in a Berkeley club, and a man from Columbia had called. Not a biggie, just another toiler in the vinyl vineyards. Neil Diamond was thinking of recording one of his songs, a tune called Baby Can You Dig Your Man. Diamond was doing an album, all his own stuff except for an old Buddy Holly tune, Peggy Sue Got Married, and maybe this Larry Underwood tune. The question was, would Larry like to come up and cut a demo of the tune and then sit in on the session? Diamond wanted a second acoustic guitar, and he liked the tune a lot. Larry said yes. The session lasted 3 days. It was a good one. Larry met Neil Diamond, also Robbie Robertson, also Richard Perry. He got mentioned on the album's inner sleeve and got paid union scale. But Baby Can You Dig Your Man wound up not being recorded. On the second evening of the session, Diamond had come up with a rocking little number of his own and recorded that instead. Well, the man from Columbia said, that's too bad. It happens. Tell you what, why don't you cut the demo anyway? I'll see if there's anything I can do. So, Larry cut the demo and then found himself out on the street in L.A. Times were hard. There were a few sessions, not many. He finally got a job playing guitar in a supper club, crooning things like Softly As I Leave You and Moon River, while elderly cats talked business and sucked up Italian food. He wrote the lyrics on scraps of notepaper because otherwise he tended to mix them up or forget them altogether, chording the tune while he went, trying to look suave like Tony Bennett, vamping and feeling like an asshole. In elevators and supermarkets, he had become morbidly aware of the low Muzak that played constantly. Then, 9 weeks ago, and out of the blue, the man from Columbia had called. They wanted to release his demo as a single. Could he come in and back it? Sure, Larry said. He could do that. So he had gone into Columbia's L.A. studios on a Sunday afternoon and backed Baby Can You Dig with a song he had written for the Tattered Remnants, Pocket Savior. The man from Columbia presented him with a check for $500 and a stinker of a contract that bound Larry to more than it did the record company. He shook Larry's hand, told him it was good to have him aboard, offered him a small, pitying smile when Larry asked how the single would be promoted, and then took his leave. It was too late to deposit the check, so Larry ran through his repertoire at Gino's with it in his pocket. Near the end of his first set, he sang a subdued version of Baby Can You Dig Your Man. The only person who noticed was Gino's proprietor, who told him to save the nigger bebop for the cleanup crew. 7 weeks ago, the man from Columbia called again and told him to get a copy of Billboard. Larry ran. Baby Can You Dig was one of three hot prospects for that week. Larry called the man from Columbia back, and he had asked Larry how he would like to lunch with some of the real biggies to discuss the album. They were all pleased with the single, which was getting airplay in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Portland, Maine already. It looked as if it was going to catch. It had won a late-night Battle of the Sounds contest for 4 nights running on one Detroit soul station. No one seemed to know that Larry Underwood was white. He had gotten drunk at the luncheon and hardly noticed how his salmon tasted. No one seemed to mind that he had gotten loaded. One of the biggies said he wouldn't be surprised to see Baby Can You Dig Your Man carry off a Grammy next year. It all rang gloriously in Larry's ears. He felt like a man in a dream, and going back to his apartment, he felt strangely sure that he would be hit by a truck, and that would end it all. The Columbia biggies had presented him with another check, this one for $2,500. When he got home, Larry picked up the telephone and began to make calls. The first one was to Mort Gino Green. Larry told him he'd have to find someone else to play Yellow Bird while the customers ate his lousy undercooked pasta. Then he called everyone he could think of, including Barry Grieg of the Remnants. Then he went out and got standing up, falling down drunk. 5 weeks ago, the single had cracked Billboard's Hot 100, number 89, with a bullet. That was the week spring had really come to Los Angeles, and on a bright and sparkling May afternoon, with the buildings so white and the ocean so blue that they could knock your eyes out and send them rolling down your cheeks like marbles, he had heard his record on the radio for the first time. Three or four friends were there, including his current girl, and they were moderately done up on cocaine. Larry was coming out of the kitchenette and into the living room with a bag of Toll House cookies when the familiar KLMT slogan came on. And then Larry had been transfixed by the sound of his own voice coming out of the Technic speakers. "I know I didn't say I was coming down. I know you didn't know I was here in town. But baby, you can tell me if anyone can. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Tell me, baby, can you dig your man?" "Jesus, that's me," he had said. He dropped the cookies onto the floor and then stood gape-mouthed, stoned, and flabbergasted as his friends applauded. 4 weeks ago, his tune had jumped to 73 on the Billboard chart. He began to feel as if he had been pushed rudely into an old-time silent movie where everything was moving too fast. The phone rang off the hook. Columbia was screaming for the album, wanting to capitalize on the single's success. Assurances that this would be the biggest record in 5 years poured into his dazed ears. Agents called by the dozen. They all sounded hungry. He began to take uppers, and it seemed to him that he heard his song everywhere. One Saturday morning, he heard it on Soul Train, and spent the rest of the day trying to make himself believe that, yes, he actually had heard it. It became suddenly hard to separate himself from Julie, the girl he had been dating since his gig at Gino's. She introduced him to all sorts of people, few of them people he really wanted to see. Her voice began to remind him of the prospective agents he heard over the telephone. In a long, loud, acrimonious argument, he split with her. She had screamed at him that his head would soon be too big to fit through a recording studio door, that he owed her $500 for dope, that he was the 1980s answer to Bo Donaldson in the Haywoods. She had threatened to kill herself. Afterward, Larry felt as if he had been through a long pillow fight in which all the pillows had been treated with a low-grade poison gas. They had begun cutting the album 3 weeks ago, and Larry had withstood most of the for-your-own-good suggestions. He used what leeway the contract gave him. He got three of the tattered remnants, Barry Grieg, Al Spellman, and Johnny McCall, and two other musicians he had worked with in the past, Neil Goodman and Wayne Stuckey. They cut the album in 9 days, absolutely all the studio time they could get. Columbia seemed to want an album based on what they thought would be a 20-week career. Larry wanted more. The album cover was a photo of Larry in an old-fashioned clawfoot tub full of suds. Written on the tiles above him in a Columbia secretary's lipstick were the words Pocket Savior and Larry Underwood. Columbia had wanted to call the album Baby, Can You Dig Your Man, but Larry absolutely balked, and they had finally settled for a Contains the Hit Single sticker on the shrink wrap. 2 weeks ago, the single hit number 47, and the party had started. He had rented a Malibu beach house for a month, and after that things got a little hazy. People wandered in and out, always more of them. He knew some, but mostly they were strangers. He could remember being huckstered by even more agents who wanted to further his great career. He could remember a girl who had bum-tripped and gone screaming down the bone-white beach as naked as a jay. He could remember snorting coke and chasing it with tequila. He could remember being shaken awake on Saturday morning, it must have been a week or so ago, to hear Casey Kasem spin his record as a debut song at number 36 on American Top 40. He could remember taking a great many reds and vaguely dickering for the Datsun Z with a $4,000 royalty check that had come in the mail. And then it was June 13th, 6 days ago, the day Wayne Stuckey asked Larry to go for a walk with him down the beach. It had only been 9 in the morning, but the stereo was on, both TVs, and it sounded like an orgy was going on in the basement playroom. Larry had been sitting in an overstuffed living room chair, wearing only underpants, and trying owlishly to get the sense from a Superboy comic book. He felt very alert, but none of the words seemed to connect to anything. There was no gestalt. A Wagner piece was thundering from the quad speakers, and Wayne had to shout 3 or 4 times to make himself understood. Then Larry nodded. He felt as if he could walk for miles. But when the sunlight struck Larry's eyeballs like needles, he suddenly changed his mind. No walk, uh-uh. His eyes had been turned into magnifying glasses, and soon the sun would shine through them long enough to set his brains on fire. His brains felt tinder dry. Wayne, gripping his arm firmly, insisted. They went down to the beach, over the warming sand, to the darker brown hardpack, and Larry decided it had been a pretty good idea after all. The deepening sound of the breakers coming home was soothing. A gull, working to gain altitude, hung straining in the blue sky like a sketched white letter M.